Welcome to the first episode of the Edge Riders podcast with Zana or Zelf for Human Centric Internet. Today we are interviewing Noah, and the conversation will be exploring Noah's visions and thoughts of a utopian internet, as well as some of Noah's history. We've been talking quite a bit ahead of time, and we've recently been introduced to each other, and it was kind of with a shebang and a lot of checked boxes to give a roundabout exploration into what you've explored previously is legal infrastructures mixed with AI and the ethical complications that come thereof. You've explored ethical hacking and working with radically open security, as well as psychology and programming and many more, it seemed like. And now you're entering a master's program at Oxford in like two weeks.
Yeah.
To start off, if we go about it from a chronological order, where would that lead us to start?
I'm Noah, and I think like my journey started as a politically aware and interested human being quite young. I don't know, I was 12 or so when I really somehow caught fire for a topic that now is actually all over the world and more in the headlines, but back then was not so much. And that's really just like, yeah, how can we get to a world with 100% renewable energy as fast as possible? And that was my utopia, my first political utopia of that really inspired me and got me going. And came from a small town in southern Germany. I started to like travel to different places and try to like, you know, protest and all these things. Did internships with research institutions and political institutions and think tanks and like all these things. And then there came a second phase at some point, because I realized, well, somehow in the end, in all these discussions that I had with politicians and lobbyists and activists, in the end, you know, like we can all discuss this and how that there's an imperative how we need to change our world due to the ecological boundaries of our world. But in the end, still, the economic argument wins somehow. It always does in the political arena, or it tends to. And I was really frustrated by that. And so I was like, well, if the economic argument wins, maybe I should learn better how it works. And I really got into business ethics. And I was like, back then, how could we reimagine how the economy and how businesses work, because to challenge that paradigm of that it's only about money making, and but it's much more about human thriving and the common good, and that these are the contributions that companies should aim for. So, and then from there on I realized, well, but what really drives companies and what really shapes how, because companies also can be really slow, or the economy can be really slow to develop. And then realized, well, the single force that right now is changing companies and the economy most is technology. And so if we get this one right, then we have a chance to really combine the power of
the economy right.
Yeah, if we get the technological change right, then that's also a really good opportunity to just change how our economy works and how our society works for the better. So like technology is what's right now is the moving pieces that right now are shaping new things, and we have the opportunity to co-shape. Our generation has the opportunity to co-shape these technological changes. And I think that's the opportunity I want to take, so that we can use the technology together with our human insights and intuitions and values to make a more humane society, economy, and planet.
So I'm curious now. We've talked a little bit about this before.
Yeah.
About technology being power, and we also talked about how Oxford was Hogwarts. And coders are the wizards of today. Framing it in that perspective, is an egalitarian world something worth fighting for? And if it is, what is technology and the knowledge thereof? What place does it have?
I think, generally, I find egalitarian philosophy very appealing, in particular, to be very rough, like John Rawls's idea that inequality, that generally there should be, first of all, in terms of freedoms, they should be equal, and everybody should have some basic civil liberties. And then when we look at material conditions, that, to be very rough again, the difference principle is, according to John Rawls, is that an unequal distribution of resources only then legitimate if it actually benefits those that are least well off. So when an unequal distribution can lead to, for example, that overall there's just much more resources, including for the least well off to go around. And I think right now we're definitely at a point, I would say, where we don't justify, or our current system is not justified by that standard, in the sense that we use technology often not centered on the most vulnerable people in our communities and societies, very much on enriching those that already have, and the whole also Silicon Valley culture, even if it purports to plan the world, to save the world, really is, in the end, all those startups get bought up by venture capitalists that then are again owned by the ones that already currently own the world. So
competing.
Exactly. And I find that sad that all this beautiful technology that could be built into really meaningful things, in the end, like, I mean, nobody says that all the social media companies we have now, or all those giants, needed to go the direction they had to. It was just that the society in which the technology arrived was one in which these kind of innovations were immediately put into under profit maximizing pressure. And
copyright?
And copyright is also one part of it, yes. I could imagine very different ways of arriving there. But then again, I think, like, my philosophy that I developed around this is kind of really being willing to think very radical and very big about how things could be different, but then really starting from where we are right now. So I really don't like just complaining about how things should be very different. I like to also do things. And that's also when I didn't like only talking about business ethics, but I also got into social entrepreneurship and founded companies myself and try to not just talk about how business should be run differently, try to do it.
Okay,
and it's hard.
Just as a tidbit, because we're not going to stay in social entrepreneurship.
Yeah, yeah.
But as a tidbit of what's goal that you found from your time in there? And I don't mean goal as in capitalist value.
Yeah.
I mean goal as in what did you find that you brought with you on your new journey?
I think generally the methodologies of business can often be very useful if they're used to different ends. So like basically the idea of Muhammad Yunus, the founder of social business, to use business means for social ends, to solve really social problems and not for the kind of problems they've been conventionally associated with. But that's not an original thought, so even though I want to credit it. But I think one more original thought that I had was kind of like that it really helped me to develop my own philosophy that I call pragmatic idealism. At this point, I can summarize it in three models. And first kind of is hope without critical thinking is just naivety. But critical thinking without hope is just cynicism. And then the second idea is confidence without humility is just arrogance. But then humility without confidence is just sheepishness.
And that's your own personal philosophy for how you view yourself throughout the world?
Exactly. And then the third...
Does it tie back to...
And there's multiple people that inspired us, including Maria Popova, a Bulgarian writer, but also many others. And then like the last sentence kind of is more like the synthesis of it all, I would say, which is pragmatism without idealism is just opportunism. But idealism without pragmatism is just wishful thinking. So that's kind of my philosophy, that's the gold, I would say, I found.
Yeah.
That pragmatism and idealism need to work together if you really want to. Yeah, I think especially like the first two probably are more inspired by also other people, but really just like pragmatism and idealism, you need to live in the space between the two. And so really have ambitious goals, but also be really pragmatic where you start with it.
If we go back to the origin of the ambitious goals, so to speak, if you were to start sketching out the image of what those ambitious goals for, let's say, if one was to reshape the internet.
Yeah.
Plural. What would that look like for you?
I don't have like one overarching, but I think I have several, again, utopias for this, or different utopian visions. I took an international relations course in my undergrad degree in Amsterdam in social sciences, and I was thinking about, well, how does international relations and global politics fit into the cyberspace that we increasingly live in, and in the internet. And I just was writing and trying to combine like this global politics theories with these new technologies. And then I just, for some reason, wrote these words like cyber peace and cyber war. And I just noticed that my computer, for some reason, underlined cyber peace as like an unknown word, but cyber war it recognized. And then I looked up in different word processing programs, none of them knew cyber peace, but all of them knew cyber war.
Yeah.
I looked up in different online dictionaries and like not all of them knew cyber war, but very few knew cyber peace.
Yeah.
And so I was just like, well, that's interesting. The vocabulary that we have, the conceptual space of the internet, is we conceptualize it as war. We don't even know how to talk about it in terms of peace because we don't have a word for it.
Yeah.
And just that obvious asymmetry that it somehow needs to be a very aggressive and violent place apparently out there, in, at least in the language we use, that kind of made me think there's some utopia missing. And then I started to develop that a bit more in this academic context initially, where and for example, what I found interesting is when you look at cyber peace, maybe we look at peace in the real world first.
Mm-hmm.
And like there were always like ideas of world peace. They've always existed, but somehow we've not achieved it yet. So just one very common idea of world peace was always Immanuel Kant, the philosopher, who in 1795 wrote an essay, it's called Perpetual Peace, or Zum ewigen Frieden in the original. There he basically purported that just the simple hypothesis kind of is the states with the republican constitutions or democracies, basically, they should all just guarantee each other security. And when they do that, then we could have an ever-expanding union of peace, because nobody would ever attempt to attack such a block of countries, and we could have an ever-expanding union of peace.
One thing that's been discussed a lot recently, especially in the realms of internet and internet infrastructures, is the issue of centralization. In that kind of utopian image of a block of peace, so to speak,
absolutely.
One could also say a block of empire, which would then set the frames for the rest of the world.
I absolutely agree. And like I think it's really interesting that like actually back then, again, I don't want to get too much into Kant, to wrap Kant up. He said we don't need a centralized contract or institution for this. We don't need like treaties for this. This should just emerge out of enlightenment, basically, of enlightened actions of individuals and countries. Again, 18th century philosophy maybe doesn't completely explain the internet, but I think there are some interesting things when you actually apply it. And again, because the internet is a very different beast. If you look at the long-term trends, again, we have not achieved world peace, but overall we live in a more peaceful world than ever before. And in the last 100 years, we did have a lot of progress. And I think we should continue to have that progress, because right now when we speak about the internet, we just speak a lot about, like there's a lot about, it's so insecure, and there's cyber crime, and there's cyber war between the countries and all that. And I think like what we really should aim for is really to have this utopian vision, and how I think that can actually happen in cyberspace much more than in real world. I think cyberspace is actually could be a much more peaceful place than the world we live in physically. And that is because of the different dynamics of security in the cyberspace. It's very asymmetric, and it's very different from other security thinking of like 20th century Cold War thinking, which often has been the only dominant security paradigm that has been applied to the internet. Because the common story is, in the internet, you just like you don't know who's your attacker. Basically, it's very difficult to do attribution of attackers. So you just want to develop your own offensive capability and hack everyone, and you can just do it. And that's basically what US have been doing, and Russia have been doing, and China have been doing, many other countries aspire to do. And there's also, again, like these superpowers that are emerging, and it's basically trying to copy these old patterns into this new world. And I don't think, first of all, I don't think that's how it's going to work out. And first of all, I don't think it's desirable, and it doesn't work that way. And that's because of this asymmetry in the internet, that you don't know who your attacker really is. Attribution is very difficult, so you can't retaliate. Just because you have offensive capabilities, right? Because you have cyber weapons, because you have, in the end, vulnerabilities that you know about, exploits that you can enter into other systems. Just because you can attack someone doesn't mean that they want to attack you, because you again, the offensive capability you have is not a deterrence against somebody else's attack, which in the physical world is very different. If you have a nuclear bomb, you know the other person's not going to bomb you so much, because you can bomb them back.
Because you can't trace back.
Exactly. And this logic of Cold War in that sense doesn't work anymore in the internet.
Yeah.
A second reason for that is basically you can destroy somebody else's offensive capability by building up your own defenses. If you do really good IT security for yourself, and if you do IT security research and you find vulnerabilities, if you find zero days, then you can basically destroy the offensive capabilities of others, because they rely on these vulnerabilities. And so, you know, if I have a nuclear bomb, just because you built some protection doesn't mean I don't have a nuclear bomb. But if I have a zero day, which is basically an exploit to which no fix is there yet, and you close that gap, then I don't have a bomb anymore. I don't have a weapon anymore. So basically, you can take away somebody else's offensive capability by building good defenses. I think these dynamics have not been fully understood by policymakers.
Is that something you would call cyber peace? You can build up defenses, and by having a safety rather than an offensive.
Yeah, I think like when my vision for cyber peace is that states should and everything else, everybody else, I don't think security must always be so state-centric. My vision for cyber peace is that basically everybody in a certain union, and it doesn't have to be a contractual union, works towards building collective defenses. So basic, for example, like very basic things, zero-day reporting. A global norm for zero-day reporting. That countries that join a certain, even just an idea, that they or that follow this idea can start to report 0 days and never include and never improve not only their security but security of everybody else. And again, like many people might say, this sounds so super idealistic, and I don't think it is. I think there's very pragmatic reasons to do so, because if you're part of this defensive union, then you can really you will be much safer than if you don't share any of your 0 days and you just try to keep and build your own offensive capabilities for all the reasons that I've named, because own offensive capabilities can be destroyed by enemies, and because of having offensive capability is not a deterrent against attacks.
So if you have a union, there must be something that's the them. There's the us and there's the them.
Yeah.
Is that what you imagine for a utopian internet then?
Generally, I would apply this kind of Kantian idea that in the end we want to live on a peaceful planet or in a peaceful cyberspace. My vision is that we, in the end, have a safe space in the internet in that sense, and that we start by creating small safe spaces and they start expanding until in the end, hopefully they cover. I always think they will be like, there will always be cyber attacks, but we can minimize their impact and we can increase the integrity of everybody's experience in the internet by for example having a global norm for 0 day reporting. And I find what I like about the global norm for 0 day reporting is it encourages everyone to contribute to everyone's security, because you can't just close a 0 day vulnerability for yourself, you do it for everyone. And at the same time, the only them that basically you create is the people that don't want to work together to make everyone's experience safer, and the them is basically the people that want to keep the exploits to, for example, I don't know, whether it is NSA hackers or whether it is malicious Russian hackers or whatever groups, only the people that kind of want to be able to really attack other people's systems are the them kind of that would be against. I think what I like with this is it's not so much that I have a very clear institutional setup how this would work, because obviously it's very difficult to control these kind of things
the
and to create. Exactly. So I don't, it's not fully developed, but I think it's kind of like, my point is more like this narrative shift from, we talk about a place where there's a lot of war happening, cyber war, to a place where cyber peace is possible and where we should make cyber peace and not cyber or cyber love rather than cyber war.
Whose responsibility is it to make this shift happen?
I think
is
in the
it?
End it's everyone's, but I think if I should put my hope on, for example, individual institutions, I think institutions that are very well set to do this, or where I have a realistic hope for this, is the European Union. If the European Union were to start such a project where they say, okay, we as a group of countries decide that we want to start a norm that everyone ought to report 0 days, because it's better for everyone to do that, I think that could be very powerful. And I know that the current administration, for example, in the US, which obviously controls the most powerful capability there, is not going to be willing to do that. But I have hope that that could change, given also the large trajectory of history. I hope that it is possible, you know.
Yeah.
Also for other countries, I have hope that that in the same way that we didn't think, or that it seemed impossible to ever start a counter proliferation movement in the nuclear age, and it seemed we will for eternity always just create more bombs to kill each other.
Mm-hmm.
We now actually live a world where there's still too many bombs, but at least less than 50 years ago. And in the same way, I have a hope that in 50 years, I know it's a long shot and it's not going to happen overnight. And right now, all the talks on UN level are basically non-existent on this topic. But I really hope that we could live in a world where we have less and not more attacks and more integrity of everybody's devices.
You've been working a bit with AI, machine learning, and specifically on the focus of whether it's ethical if placed in a legal system.
Yeah.
Do you want to expand on that?
Yeah, of course.
Little?
So I think kind of like that was my work that I started or that I did 2 years ago that I kind of now talked about this narrative shift to cyber peace. And what I didn't like about it is that it was, apart from that it was like state-centric and that there were many practical problems with it and very long shot, it was still defensive. It was still like, it's talking about my utopia is security or safety, which yeah. is still something like the absence of violence. That's the mm-hmm. problem with peace also, you know? It's not in that sense super positive, it's only that bad things are not there.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I want something more positive than that. And that's then where I got also more into this AI space, and because I think there really there's opportunity to positively shape human thriving in many ways,
mm-hmm.
and to unlock this potential we need to also avoid many risks that are often also discussed and that are very real. And the as I said also, I on the AI field, I don't yet have this super clear utopia, because somehow every utopia that involves machines that can do more than we do in some sense apparently ends up being a dystopia sometimes. And so we have to still do a lot of work on which utopia we actually want to have there.
So in your utopia?
Mm, sir?
In your utopia?
In my utopia.
Does AI exist?
In my utopia, again, I'm a pragmatic idealist, so somehow my ideals are also based on my pragmatism, and I think there is not a world possible. Like, we cannot, I don't know if you heard about the Unabomber, who's like a guy who started basically bombing scientists because he believed that the progress of science and technology will destroy human thriving. And
yeah.
given that, I don't think that's a viable path, that we will basically live with less technology. Then the question is, how can we shape the current trends and the current technologies that are arising to human benefit? And also, maybe sometimes also, how can we consciously decide not to use them? Yeah, we can sometimes do that, but overall, I'm convinced that we will get machines that will be better at humans at many tasks that currently only humans can do. Given that that's going to come, the question is, how do we want to do that? I think there the biggest problems are exactly about human centrism. So how can we make sure that they align with our values? And there's been like, there's a long-term perspective, I would say, on this question, which is kind of like AI governance questions that has been, for example, pioneered by Nick Bostrom, the whole ideas of what do we do when there's a general AI that actually is smarter than humans. I think these are super valuable questions to deal with and to research. But then there's also the short-term questions, and that's more what I've been dealing with. And these are more the questions of, if we already today have, for example, a system that makes legal decision, for example, in an administration, in a public administration,
mm-hmm.
what values do we want to be imbued into that? Do we think it's just fine if there's some human mandate and humans and some democratically elected institution decides now we want this to be done by an AI? Or do we also think there needs to be some outputs that need to be in some material sense fair? Is it just if it's cheaper and faster, do we just accept it? Or do we also want to actually be able to understand the process to be accessible for humans? Because then many advanced machine learning programs currently, they're black boxes for us, so we can't really understand them. Then the other question is, well, if it's trained on any human data, human-centric data also in that sense, then it's going to take human biases with it, and it could even aggregate them and exaggerate them. And so, yeah, there's a lot of open questions, and I don't really have full answers to those yet. But I my utopia is just, I can only explain it in very abstract terms at this point, because there's still a lot of research and thinking and testing and acting to be done on this field. But right now it's to reap the benefits, to avoid the risks, and to make sure that we humanize the technology that we live with, in the sense that we really challenge also what it means to be human for ourselves. Because I don't think we know right now what it means to be human. And
yeah.
if we first figure out, like, or if we figure out what it means to be human, then we can also tell what we want technology to do to help us to thrive.
Thank you so much for laying forth your thoughts. I'm got a feeling that we will hear more from you.
Well, thank you very, very much for giving me this space, and I'm very grateful for your time and for your work.